This is Audible.
Shadow Mountain presents The Other Side of the Bridge, a novel by Cameron Wright. This unabridged presentation is performed for you by Nancy Peterson and Tristan Morris.
Chapter 1. San Francisco, California, 2012. The damp metal nudges me forward. The waves open their welcoming fingers. The night's darkness offers to hide my shame. All whisper a single question that reaches up through the fog and catches in my throat. If I, Katie Connolly, were to jump from this bridge tonight, would my death matter? Father Muldowney, my priest, says life is precious. He quotes a 16th-century monk who said, "Midst all our frailty, fault, and sin, shines our heart, a light within, ere we must then stay the end and cherish life to live again." I wonder if when the poet wrote those words, he knew what it was like to lose every person dear to him. In truth, I didn't come to jump. I came only to glimpse death, to gauge his strength, to know what I can expect when it's my turn. I decide to crawl back over the railing and return home, but as I twist around, the steel beneath my feet trembles, and I lose my grip. My feet slide out from under me, and I stumble. I flail for the railing, but it's too late. I collapse into the clouds as the dank sea air rushes past. I don't fear death until my father calls from the bridge above. "Katie, where are you?" I scream for him as I descend, but the wind swallows my cry. I yell louder, but the sound falls with me. "Katie!" When they find my body, he will think that I jumped. I can't have him believe that I jumped. More than anything, I want to live. I wish to be back with my father, to tell him he's important, to let him know that I love him. But my wishes are worthless. After hitting the surface, I'll plunge deep into the blackness of the bay. For any hope of survival, I'll need to take a deep breath just before impact. I try to suck in air, but my chest tightens and my lungs freeze. I writhe and struggle. I tumble and fall, desperate for one more breath that never comes. It's always the same when I awake. My sheets are wet. I shiver, and my chest heaves as I gasp for air. It's a terrible dream, a horrendous nightmare. Yet I despair every time I awake and it comes to an end. In my dream, my father is still alive. My birth name is Catherine Ann Connolly, though most people call me Katie. I work in the history department at San Francisco State University as a research assistant. It's a solitary job, but it suits me. In truth, I should be the one directing the research projects. At 26, I have 2 undergraduate degrees and a master's degree I finished last spring. I didn't plan to live the life of a professional student. I've just been a tad lost since my father's death 2 years ago last April. He was a hard man to give up. My boss, Professor James Winston II, has just handed me a research request. He's a good friend, a second father, and I'm sure he believes this assignment will help me in a therapeutic sort of way. He means well, but he should stick to history. It seems the university was asked by the Golden Gate Commemorative Society to prepare a packet of information for the state's school system. Our portion will be a booklet titled Our Heritage, A History of the Golden Gate Bridge. I'm concerned about this particular assignment because of my father and the memories it will dredge up. You see, My father worked on the bridge for 29 years of his life. Professor Winston says that's why I'd be perfect, because I already know so much about the structure. Of course, he also tells me that I need to date, that I should find a good man. The professor is full of nonsense. Speaking of nonsense, I talk to him. My father, I mean. I have conversations with him as if he were still here. Sometimes I even think I can feel him near. Other times, after I catch myself talking to a dead person, I realize that I may be stepping a bit over the crazy line, and I do my best to jump back. It's been a little over 2 years, and I know it's time to get over losing him. It's time I got on with life. I've even considered moving, getting away from the bridge, the university, the city, the memories. But each time I think that I've banked enough courage, I come up wanting. I don't date much. I don't get asked. I'm sure it's my fault. Though don't misunderstand, I look after myself. I watch what I eat and stay fit. And men do seem to find my athletic build and slim features attractive. The fact is, I'm miserable to be around. Not in a rude sort of way, but in a lonely sort of way. Enough about my better traits and back to matters at hand. I have until 3 today to get back to the professor before he assigns the project to another researcher. As I look over the project's notes, as I study the scope, I can see that I'd be perfect for it. I spent my childhood at the bridge. My father's stories about the structure have been ingrained in my head since I could crawl. I said that he worked on the bridge, but more than that, he loved the bridge. My father also died there.
Chapter 2. Jamesburg, New Jersey. Megan Riley, hair sopping, bath towel clinging, burst into the kitchen, beckoned by the howling smoke alarm. Her eyes darted around the room. No visible fire, no visible husband, only Angel, their youngest, a petite child who had recently turned 5. She stood peacefully beside the toaster, admiring the rising smoke, like steam from the geysers they had visited in Yellowstone Park last summer. Except today, it was dark and sooty. "Angel, where's Daddy?" Megan hollered, pouncing toward the plug. There was no need. The appliance popped on cue, perhaps in surrender, to give up its burnt offering. "Don't know, Mom," Angel answered with an innocent shrug. "But his toast is done." Although the toaster may have seeded, the smoke detector was just getting started. Megan tugged a chair beneath the alarm, balanced on it like a scantily clad circus performer, and fanned one-handed. The clamor did more than ignore her. The half-circle vents molded into the detector's puck-shaped face seemed to grin down. Brad, barely 16 and dark-haired like his father, turned the corner. He halted. His mother, dripping hair, tippy toes, clad in a tenuous towel, was flapping anxiously at the ceiling. "Now there's something you don't see every day," he deadpanned to Angel. Megan ignored him, reaching instead with a single finger on her free hand toward the one button on the blaring contraption that would silence the racket once and for all. And then she would find Dave. Just another inch and... Her chair tipped backwards. Megan screamed. The trash in the kitchen was overflowing, yet again. And running it out to the large can in the garage, before Megan had to ask, seemed like a given. The toasting bread had started out frozen. The other children hadn't come down yet. And besides, he'd be back in less than 2 minutes. In the garage, Dave straight-armed the can open and dumped, careful not to dirty his pressed shirt and silk tie. He dropped the lid, scooted back around his car, and then paused at the door. It was a beautiful thing. A BMW 650i coupe, purchased 7 months earlier. Expensive? Sure, but it was his dream machine. The first sports car he'd ever owned. He was embarrassed at the time, To approach 40 and buy a red sports car was such a cliché. Lately, he couldn't care less. His thoughts were interrupted by a sound coming from the kitchen. Was that the smoke alarm? It took only seconds after he'd pushed through the door for his eyes to scrunch, his forehead to furrow, his feet to spread. Light reflecting off the room had already traveled down his optic nerve to deliver the scene to his head, but his brain was having trouble sorting it all out. There was smoke in the kitchen, the smell of burnt toast, a deafening alarm, that all made sense. But why was Megan sitting in the middle of the floor with her knees pulled tightly against her chest, trying frantically to gather herself in a towel? Brad was the first to speak. "Dad, I..." He raised his voice to be heard above the noise, but then the smoke alarm, perhaps growing bored, silenced itself. "Dad," he repeated, not wasting the moment. "I believe your toast is ready." Dave's eyes were still looking for answers. He reached down to help Megan up, but she wouldn't reach back. Dave turned instead to his youngest daughter. "Angel, I asked you to watch the toaster," he chided. Her tiny yet determined voice was adamant.
"I did watch it, Daddy. I watched it the whole time."
Silence swept the room, an eerie stillness, like one might expect in a death chamber. Then Megan, still double-clutching her towel, began to giggle uncontrollably. The family had tried to schedule daily breakfasts together, but with people heading in so many different directions, it was not working out. Dinner time hadn't been much better, with baseball, piano, and dance lessons all making their demands on the family. While Megan finished getting ready, Dave checked his watch, then quick stirred a pan of scrambled eggs. Brittany, their middle child, entered, apparently completely unaware of the morning's fiasco, though Brad would contend she was unaware of everything but boys. Dave scooped eggs onto her plate while Brittany settled into her chair. She was their child who never rushed, despite always being late. After all, it was only school. She had all day. She tossed back her long brown hair, the color of their mother's, in a gesture that reminded Dave of Megan, and of the fact that his daughter was growing up.
"Did Mom tell you who I like?" Brittany asked.
"No. Should she?"
"I told her not to."
"So, who do you like?" Dave asked, taking the obvious bait.
"Promise not to tell?"
Dave tried to picture anyone who would care. He couldn't.
"I promise." "Jason Wilson. He's hot."
"How old are you again?"
"Duh, Dad, I'll be turning 13 in a year."
Dave opened his mouth, but decided silence was his best ally. Brad hustled back to the room.
"I'm out of here." He bent close to stare into Dave's eyes. "Dad, listen. Don't forget. Game tonight, 6 p.m., at the field."
"I didn't forget last time," Dave replied, every word protesting.
"I was just running late."
Brad ignored the man to holler up the stairs.
"Pick me up at 3, Mom?"
Megan's voice echoed from a distant corner of the house.
"Do you have everything?"
"Yeah, try not to be late." He snatched his baseball mitt, backpack, and the 3 remaining pieces of toast. And, like a tailgating teenager late to a party, he was gone. Dave's phone alarm beeped. He would be late as well if he didn't leave now. Then, as if she'd been watching, Megan stepped in, dressed for the day and carrying Dave's coaching uniform. She folded it inside his briefcase and clicked the lid closed.
"I've got to run," Dave announced, picking up his suit coat.
"I know, honey. I'll see you at the game." It was meant as a reminder, not a question. She continued,
"We'll grab pizza on the way home after, if that's okay."
She leaned up to kiss him lightly on the lips, though his was a half-hearted kiss in return. He shifted his weight. It appeared he had something to say. She waited. He remained silent.
"I love you," she added, pointing to his watch.
"Yeah, I know. I love you too." He took a breath, forced a turn, and paraded once again to the garage. The car flaunted style, power, and sophistication. Dave let the leather surround him, rescue him, whisper its encouragement. Driving to work was one of the few moments of sanity he would have all day. He checked the car's clock, undecided as to whether he should slow down and savor the moment or press the gas pedal to the floor. He chose the gas. He glanced in the rearview mirror and then eased his foot down. If he drove fast enough, it was harder for the anxiety to keep up. "Perhaps I'll just keep on going today," he mused. "I'd miss my wife and family, sure, but at least I'd have my car." His tease brought a grin. Megan, on the other hand, was a minivan holdout, a vanishing breed of mothers who refused to join the modern age and trade up to an SUV. Though he appreciated her rebellious stance, what he couldn't grasp was her rationale. She actually liked her van. "It's practical, and I love the color," she would say. Dave turned onto the New Jersey Turnpike. She wasn't much younger than he, 3 years plus a month. Why was she so happy all the time when life had become so hectic, so crazy? And with the burgeoning demands at the office, things were only going to get worse. Dave was the dad. He was in charge. Why, then, did he feel like the captain of the Hindenburg? Life was passing fast, and it was all he could do to breathe. Some days were fine, but on other days, he felt like the desire had been sucked right out of him. How could he explain it to Meg? She would retort with, "Life is short, so enjoy it." But she still looked fabulous. He was the one growing old. 10 more minutes and he'd be at the lot where he'd park his car to catch the train to Manhattan. He and a million other clones. On occasion, he'd brave city traffic and drive the entire way. He considered it today, but finding a place in the company lot this late would be all but impossible. The train ride was the part of the commute he dreaded the most. It had become necessary when the firm had moved to Manhattan the previous fall. One more thing to complicate his life. He clicked on the stereo and selected his favorite playlist, Billy Joel. Ironically, the song that played first was Running on Ice. There was always a new account at the office, more activities for the kids, run to this, late to that, and what did he have to show for it? More gray hair. He needed to slow things down. But how? At times, when he was alone in the car, Dave would sing along with the lyrics. Not today. Today, he turned up the volume. "Seriously?" he mumbled as he pulled into the lot. "Am I really going to be 40? Chapter 3.
"Good morning, Mr. Riley."
Dave nodded his reply to the receptionist. She was new, and he couldn't remember her name. When he reached his office, Gloria, his personal secretary, was thankfully not at her desk. It meant he could slip inside undetected to have a few more minutes to breathe. The room's solitude, however, was both a reprieve and a punishment. Every contemplative moment he spent motionless in his chair was a missed opportunity to get a head start in his day. He'd barely arrived and guilt was already piling up at his feet. He turned his stare from the window to a company brochure on his desk. Strategy Data International was smaller than the name suggested, middle of the pack when analyzing gross revenue. However, the company was respected and aggressive, and word on the street was that in the field of strategic marketing research, this was the firm to watch. Its newly appointed president, Ellen Brewer, had taken over from her father 2 years earlier. While children in many family businesses quickly drove their respective companies into the ground, Ellen was turning out to be an exception. With her conservative father out of the way, the man's only daughter had positioned the company for growth. Though she had initially been criticized by analysts as overbearing and inexperienced, her vision was proving brilliant. Dave had never doubted. He'd known the woman long enough to be certain of one thing. Ellen Brewer would capture market share. For 52 years, the company had been headquartered in New Brunswick, just a 20-minute drive from the Riley home in Jamesburg, Ellen's first executive decision had been to relocate corporate offices to Manhattan, closer to the big-money clients and with easier access to Washington, D.C. And in the few short months since the move, revenue had already increased by 30%. While good for the company, the change had complicated life for Dave. He and Megan had talked about moving closer to the city to accommodate, but with children already established in school, sports, and other activities, it muddied the picture. Moves were hard on families, especially teenagers. And despite Megan's belief that the children would adjust, it didn't feel right to Dave. The entire situation remained a paradox. The anxiety of moving would wreak emotional havoc, but the pressures of staying were slowly doing the same. The door opened and Gloria rushed in.
"You're here! I didn't see you come in!"
Not yet ready to face the day, but with no other choice, Dave pasted on a plastic smile and stood. His secretary didn't waste any time.
"Your 10 o'clock called and would like to move your meeting to 11. I hope that works because you have lunch at noon at the Lighthouse on 37th rather than at Pompano's. Miss Brewer said she might be attending. She'll let you know in an hour. And your 3 o'clock with the new account, let's see, Ability Fitness Centers, has been moved to 4.
"To 4? Dave protested.
"I coach today. I can't be late or the kids will have me skewered.
Do you want me to cancel? I've canceled twice already.
Keep it, but be ready. I may need your help."
He watched Gloria's eyes roll, knowing she detested their routine when meetings ran long. She had barely stepped from his office when Brock Polino strutted in. Since joining the company 5 years earlier, Brock had become Dave's best friend. Ellen often teamed them up to handle important accounts, a pairing that had proved successful. The men worked well together, laughed at the same jokes, shared an appreciation of baseball and sports cars. Alike in many ways, they were also oddly different. Brock was slightly older, at 45, divorced, no children. And though he sympathized with Dave's family juggling act, Brock seemed happy to be married to his job. In many ways, it was an unlikely friendship. One man single, carefree, with little outside responsibility, the other buried in the duties of employee, coach, husband, and father, with never enough time to excel at any one of them. Perhaps it was a friendship that thrived because each envied what the other had.
"You hear the news yet?"
Brock asked, almost giddy as he closed the door. He loved office politics, lived for the gossip. "You're dating the new girl in accounting?" Dave quipped.
"Seriously, we just landed the Yorkshire account!"
Dave sighed, letting a hint of distress also escape.
"That is good news."
It was the right answer, but delivered in the wrong tone.
"Hey, come on! I thought you'd be thrilled! Our stock options are gonna be worth a mint!"
"Sure, if I don't drown first."
"Why so tense?
You need a vacation," Brock added.
"Tell me about it."
Two quick knocks came at the door before Gloria entered.
"Your 9 o'clock is waiting. I've got the numbers ready."
She handed Dave a folder. He glanced at his watch. 5 after.
"Thanks. Seat them in the conference room. I'll be right there."
"They're already there and waiting."
Dave straightened his shoulders. The gun had sounded and the day's race had begun. He turned to Brock.
"You want to continue this conversation at lunch? Clients at the Lighthouse at noon."
"I think the waitress there has a thing for you," he added, trying to insert needed levity. When Brock hesitated, Dave baited the hook.
"Look, normally I'd love to, but..."
When Brock didn't bite, especially with the boss attending, Dave's eyebrows raised. Brock's explanation was simple.
"I already have a lunch date with Janine."
"A woman, of course. That explains it." Though the name sounded familiar, Dave couldn't place the face. He turned to Brock for help.
"Janine?"
Brock headed for the door. Before closing it behind him, he let a smile slip.
"She's the new girl in accounting."
Dave glared at the wall clock, expecting it to interrupt for him. Sadly, it only glared back as Mr. Sorensen, a.k.a. King of Ability Fitness, continued to drone on about ruthless industry competition, the cost of labor, and how government regulation was killing business at all 14 of his locations. Dave didn't care. The necessary points of discussion had been covered in the first 10 minutes, and now the follow-up diatribe by Sorensen was not only making Dave late, it was boring him utterly to death. Twice Dave stood to signal that the meeting had to end. Twice Sorensen stood, hardly taking a breath, before sitting back down. At 5 minutes before the hour, Gloria opened the door. She was a woman who hated to lie, and as such, waited until the last possible minute. She wasn't a moment too soon. "Sorry to interrupt, Mr. Riley, but the senator is on the phone for you. Would you like to take the call?" Dave bit his lip to suppress a smile, knowing her message was all but true. The year prior, the firm had hired retired auto worker Axel Senator to run the mailroom. Gloria continued, "Should I tell him you're with a client?" Dave stepped into character, nodding to Mr. Sorensen. "Excuse me, I'd better take this call." Dave pushed the blinking line on the phone. "Good afternoon, Senator," Dave began. "Hey there, Mr. Riley. Gloria said you needed to speak with me." Dave pressed the receiver tightly against his ear. She obviously hadn't filled Axel in on the angle. "I'm fine." "Well, I'm fine too, sir. Is there a problem?"
"What can I do for you today?" Dave asked back, wholly ignoring Axel's question.
"What?"
Dave didn't let the man's confusion slow him down.
"I'm thrilled to hear your constituents are happy. It's amazing what we learn from market research, isn't it?"
Dave turned in time to catch the look on Sorensen's face. Saucered eyes, arching eyebrows, a mouth that puckered in childlike surprise. Axel sounded equally amazed, or perhaps confused.
"I don't know what you're talking about, Mr. Riley. This is Axel, in the mailroom. You'd like to meet? Can't you hear what I'm saying? This is Axel!"
Dave let several seconds pass.
"I'm with a client, but yes, I can leave right now."
Dave offered Sorensen an apologetic shrug.
"Of course, Senator. I'll be there immediately. Yes, I have the address in my phone. Goodbye to you too."
"What the..." Click. Dave dropped the receiver to cut off Axel mid-sentence, and then jumped to his feet. No time to waste.
"That was our senator?" a dumbfounded Sorensen asked.
"I like to think he's everybody's senator. At least that's how we think of him around here." Dave grabbed his briefcase and jacket and then opened his office door.
"He's a nice guy. You'll have to meet him someday."
Gloria already had the elevator open and helped shoo Sorensen inside. The man didn't let their herding slow down his enthusiasm. He continued speaking to Dave as the doors closed.
"Call me next week when the marketing profile is complete. We can do lunch!"
While Dave normally walked the 12 blocks to the train station, today he waved down a taxi. He hadn't had time to change, so as the cab jerked away from the curb, he opened his briefcase and removed his coach's uniform and shoes. If the driver noticed him changing, he didn't say a word. No doubt he'd seen worse. When Dave pulled on his second shoe, his toe crunched something inside. Even before he fished out the wadded paper and smoothed it flat, he knew what it was. "Just a quick note to say that I love you. See you at the game." Love notes. Megan had started writing them months earlier, to keep the passion alive. They would show up on occasion in unexpected places, and although he didn't keep track, lately they felt more frequent. He'd hoped the habit would run its course and die a forgotten death. It hadn't. Dave had tried to reciprocate by writing messages back, but he felt like a copycat, not sincere. Sending flowers was his next attempt, but with work so hectic he'd often forget. Brock suggested Dave have Gloria schedule rose deliveries at the first of every month, like Brock did for two of the women he was dating. But for Dave, scheduled love gifts were so contrived they were self-defeating. Usually, he did nothing, which only caused inadequacy and guilt to smolder. When the cab pulled up to the station,
Dave stuffed the note into his pocket, swiped his card to pay the fare, and then bolted out the door. He ran in full stride for the train, weaving his way through the crowd, business suit wadded under one arm and briefcase in the other hand. The uncooperative train seemed to crawl, and by the time Dave reached his car in New Jersey at the park-and-ride lot, he was already half an hour late. There were two other men who helped Dave coach the team, but both were out of town for today's game. Dave had assured them he would take over, no problem. He was the man. He was in charge. And he wasn't even there. He slid into the car, mumbled a quick prayer that policemen would be blind, and then he slammed down the gas. It still took 12 minutes more to reach the field. After the car squealed to a halt, Dave bolted toward the team's dugout. He could see his guys up to bat. Woody Peterson was in the box, which meant that they were already halfway through the batting order. Then Dave caught sight of Megan, clipboard in hand. She watched him approach and offered a quick wave. Angel was stacking baseballs into a pile at the corner of the dugout. "We're ahead 3-1, she glowed. "Christian is on third and Woody is batting." Megan turned to the field and hollered to the team. "It's okay! The coach is here now!" Dave ignored the disapproving parent glances to focus instead on the batting order scribbled on the scorecard. It was all out of whack. "You put Woody up to bat after Christian?" "Yeah, I sorted them by last name. It was easier that way." "But..." He wasn't sure what to say. "Don't worry, honey," she continued, reading his confusion. "Woody's small, but..." Smack. Both turned to see the boy's ball sail over the shortstop's head and drop shy of the left outfielder. Woody dashed for first, while Christian slid home to score another run. Megan beamed. "Alphabetical order," Dave muttered to himself. "Who would have guessed?" Brad was up next. He eyed Dave, nodded with confidence. Dave called to him from near the dugout. "Keep that elbow up, Brad. Study the pitcher. You can see that he's tipping his pitches." The pitch came high and outside. Ball one. Brad held steady while Dave hollered encouragement. "Watch the pitch, Brad. That's it. Wait for the one you want." The second pitch came in low. Brad let it go. "Not today," he mouthed aloud. "Not today." Ball two. The next pitch also trailed low, well below the strike zone, and Dave winced as he watched Brad swing. The pitch was low all right, but not too low for Brad. He connected solidly, sending the ball over third base and toward the left field line. The outfielder raced at full speed, and seeing it would be close, laid himself out horizontally and extended his glove. It would be the play of the game for one team or the other. Brad won. The ball touched leather, but not enough to stop, as it deflected off the mitt and rolled toward the fence. The prone outfielder sprang to his feet, but by the time he located the ball, it was too late. The runner on first touched home plate as Brad slid in at third. By the end of the game, they were 7 runs ahead, their easiest win to date. Voting was unanimous. Brad and Megan shared the game ball. After the equipment had been gathered, Dave, Megan, and crew headed toward the parking lot. "Can you take Angel?" Megan asked. "Brad's coming with me. We'll pick up Brittany and the pizza and meet you at home." "Sure. Let's go, Squirt." Dave loaded the game gear while Megan transferred Angel's car seat. As he helped his daughter get properly strapped in, Megan drove away in the van before quickly circling back. She must have forgotten something. Dave waited for his wife to slow down and stop, but she didn't. That was when he noticed Brad behind the wheel. As the van passed, Megan held up Brad's new license from the passenger seat for Dave to see. Dave was speechless. In the rush of things, he'd completely forgotten that this was Brad's big day. Only Angel spoke.
"Daddy, Brad's driving.
I think you should call the police."
Chapter 4 By 9:30, Angel was tucked into bed, well past her bedtime. Another half hour had passed before the girl quit talking and drifted off to sleep. Dave waited for Megan at the jacuzzi out on the back deck, one of the few places they could talk without interruption. Dave studied her features as she slid into the bubbling water and closed her eyes. Wispy hair curled across her shoulders. Slender eyebrows balanced over a freckled nose. Lips turned up just enough naturally on each end that she always appeared to be smiling. Even the kids joked that when Mom was angry, she still looked happy about it. If asked about her appearance, Megan would be the first to point out the wrinkles now showing at the corners of her eyes. Dave would contend they only compounded her beauty with added badges of experience and wisdom. "What?" Megan finally asked, sensing that she was being watched. "I'm just thinking." And he was. In the steamy solitude, his thoughts drifted to the first time they'd met, 18 years earlier, Psychology 102. He was filling elective credits he needed to graduate. She was just beginning work on what would become an art degree. Their first class assignment was to bring a picture showing something they feared. By a simple twist of fate, they'd sat adjacent that day, and she'd laid her photo on the table, one taken in her early teenage years, riding Disneyland's Space Mountain. He leaned forward and picked the curious photo up. It had caught his eye, because sitting directly behind the wide-eyed, attractive girl screaming her lungs out from the front seat was Dave. Despite the resemblance, Megan didn't believe at first that it was him, until he recited the month and year the photo was taken. It wasn't the only coincidence. It turned out their families had lived barely 2 blocks apart. Their fathers had attended the same Rotary Club, and despite multiple college scholarship opportunities elsewhere, each had selected the same university. They dated for just 4 months before he proposed, and barely 3 months later, their married life together started. Those had been carefree days, a far cry from the current rush. "Do you think we're too busy?" Dave finally questioned, letting the thought that had been gnawing at him all week swirl with the steam. Megan opened her eyes, then tried to whisk his worry away the way she always did, with humor. "We have way too much happening to worry about questions like that. I'm not joking." She considered him seriously, took a moment to answer. "Yes, I think we are. But it's by our own choice, isn't it?" "But is it the right choice?" "What would you cut out?" she asked. "Baseball? Dance? Piano? Better yet, which child should we sell?" "I'm not sure," Dave answered, with no hint of a smile, before he clarified. "I mean, about the activities, not the child-selling part." "For having just won the game, you seem pretty down. What's wrong?" His words were quieter now, mixing freely with the sound of anxious bubbles. "Do you ever feel like you're so busy that you're letting dreams slip by?" "What are you talking about? Did you get any painting done today, for example?" "I finger-painted with Angel. Does that count?" "I'm serious." "I can see that. Today was my day to help out at the school. You know that. See what I mean? We need more time." She was relaxing. He was stewing. "Honey," she interrupted, "I enjoy my art, but honestly, I can paint any time. Watching my kids grow up, being there with them, with you, I'm living my dream." He heard her assurance, but his eyes answered that he didn't completely believe her. "Honestly, what's the matter?" she asked again. "I just..." The night air seemed to reach down his throat and steal his words, tie up his thoughts. He felt so apprehensive, so unsure how to explain. "I don't know. I feel, well, it's like the song says, I'm running on ice. My legs are moving, but I'm not going anywhere. I feel like I'm in the dream where you run to catch the train, the last train of the day, and you run and run and run,
stretching and stretching until you're out of breath and your legs ache. But it's always just out of reach.
Megan splashed up straight. Her eyes brightened, as if a light had clicked on.
Wait, it's because of your birthday, isn't it?
What do you mean?
You're turning 40. You're worried. Honey, it's still 3 weeks away, and I'm the one getting the wrinkles. We have a terrific life. Let's enjoy it.
His head knew she was right. How could he argue? If only he could convince the anxiety punching at his chest to listen.
Maybe it's just the schedule that's getting to me.
Megan reached for his hands and locked her eyes on his.
Life is great, she repeated. Have a little faith in it, would you?
I will, he said, before he hesitated.
Sometimes it feels like I'm missing out on something. That's all.
Like what? How could he explain it when even he didn't understand? He had a great job, a terrific wife, amazing children. Why the trepidation? His answer, learned from Megan, was to make light of the situation, humor to the rescue. When you can't face the truth, you joke about it.
You won't laugh? He asked Megan.
Probably.
Tell me anyway. I've always wanted to buy a motorcycle and ride across the country.
Megan chuckled.
A motorcycle? Like a Harley?
Why not?
In your suit and tie?
Of course not. I'd get a black leather jacket, the kind with padding on the elbows and zippered pockets.
Would you grow a ponytail?
Just for me?
Sure, and perhaps a beard.
I'd ride across the country until I came to the Golden Gate Bridge. That's where I'd end up.
Did you know my grandfather helped build that bridge?
Dad said he loved it. He used to say that it was magical.
Yes, you've mentioned that.
So you'd ride to the bridge?
Not just to it. I'd ride across it.
Across the bridge?
Yep.
It would be the 4th of July. The sun would be shining, the sky would be bright and clear, a slight breeze would be blowing over the ocean and through my hair.
Through your ponytail, she specified, evidently trying her best to tamp down a laugh.
He nodded.
And people would stare, not daring to say anything aloud, but to themselves.
To themselves, they would whisper, "That guy is so cool."
It was born as a playful, fictional scene, sketched in charcoal strokes of black and gray and white, never meant to be taken seriously. But as Dave spoke the words aloud, as they stretched and breathed and filled in space of their own, the vision in his head turned to rich, descriptive color.
Megan let him silently swirl in his moment of glory before asking the obvious.
"I am curious, Mr. Ponytail Man. What happens after you cross the bridge?"
Absorbed in the imagery, he let contentment linger.
"It wouldn't matter," he finally concluded, satisfaction glowing in his face.
"And why not?"
"It wouldn't matter because at the very moment I crossed the bridge, I have experienced the best that life had to offer. I'd have lived my dream. I'd have arrived."
It was picture perfect.
"I think you've been in the hot water way too long," Megan concluded, as she reached her arms around his waist and pulled herself tight, kissing him ever so lightly on the neck.
"Let's get out and go to bed, and I'll give you something real to smile about."
Chapter 5. My father was an iron worker on the Golden Gate. It doesn't sound glamorous to the average person. Perhaps it doesn't sound glamorous to anyone. It's the kind of job you brag about to your friends when you're in elementary school, but learn to hide as you grow older. Iron worker. It rolls off the tongue much harsher than teacher or salesman. Everyone accepts that it's not in the same league as lawyer or dentist or fill in the blank with just about any professional occupation. But what I now realize, since he's been gone, is that my father's job was worth more than all of those careers combined. You see, during his years working on the bridge, he not only raised a little girl on his own, my father also saved 28 lives. He was part of an elite group of men who, in addition to maintaining one of the world's most miraculous structures, was trained to stop people from jumping off it to their deaths. It's an odd combination, meshing the traits of a burly iron worker with those of a compassionate psychologist. Men who work at the bridge are tough men, hard men. They have to be to handle the gate. And yet, at the same time, they can be caring, sensitive men. At least, that was the case with my father. I think that's why he was so good at his job. So able to help people who had, for one reason or another, decided that life was too much to bear. People will ask why iron workers are the ones who stop the jumpers, rather than the police or paramedics. The answer is simple. When a jumper climbs over the railing and edges out onto a treacherous area of the bridge, the iron workers are not only the first ones to the scene, they are also the only ones daring enough to follow. It was a volunteer assignment, and I remember only one short period of time when my father gave it up and took himself off the list. It was the day I turned 16, the same day he took me out to breakfast to celebrate because he'd been working late that night, the same day I blew out 16 candles that poked out of a ham and cheese omelet. It was also the same day that he watched a father jump from the bridge after first throwing his 2-year-old daughter ahead of him. It tore my father apart. When he arrived home late that night, he was crying. He decided the stress was too much to handle for a single father trying to raise a balanced teenage daughter. Within weeks, however, he'd changed his mind and was back at work, talking people down. When I asked him later what had caused his change of heart, he admitted that although the job could be dreadfully painful, it was more difficult not to do than to do. Simply put, my dad was selfless.
Work at the office had been frenzied, no surprise. With Ellen Brewer in charge, expectations were high. Market share was the name of the game, and like everyone, Dave took on more work than he could handle. He had just finished quantifying marketing results for Lansing Financial when Gloria buzzed his office.
Mr. Riley, there's an Abel Lawless from the governor's office on line 3 asking for you.
For just a moment, the name startled him. Lawless? Then he chuckled. He and Brock had begun trading practical jokes on April Fool's Day, shortly after Brock first hired on. He'd called Dave on the phone, pretending to be from Google, wanting to offer him a job in California. Dave returned the prank a week later with the delivery of phony legal papers claiming action against Brock in a paternity suit. The jokes continued back and forth, usually no more than one a month to ensure things didn't get out of hand. As the pranks were generally harmless, Ellen winked at the fun, understanding that it added levity to an otherwise stressful environment. Bogus calls were Brock's specialty, and had included dead-on impersonations of an IRS agent, Mark Cuban, and even a birthday gram singer who pretended to have an appointment with Gloria. When David related the story to Brock about Axel calling from the mailroom, Brock couldn't quit laughing. Dave picked up the line, trying to think of a clever ploy. "This is Dave, discoverer of not-so-funny pranks. Who might you be?" Silence. Then the voice on the line said, "Hello, this is Abel Lawless, the governor's policy director in Florida. A friend recommended you. I'm in town for a few days attending a diversity conference at the Javits Center. I'd like to get together to discuss using your firm for a marketing study as part of the rights initiative we'll be pushing next spring." Dave laughed into the receiver. Brock would have to do better than that. "A diversity conference, you say?" Brock was relentless, but Dave could take it. "For diversity's sake, we need to hire someone around here who thinks Brock is funny."
I'm sorry. I'm not sure that I follow.
At that moment, the door kicked open and Brock strolled in. He could see that Dave was on the phone, so he plopped down into the adjacent chair to wait. Dave quit talking. His stomach tightened and his breathing stopped. He looked to Brock, then to the phone, then back to Brock.
Oh, no, he whispered, loud enough to let his anxious words spill across the floor.
Puzzled, Brock added a shrug.
What? What did I do?
Megan ducked out of Angel's kindergarten class early and headed to the mall. She had 45 minutes before she had to return to pick up her daughter. At the moment, she had one mission, to find a present for Dave's surprise party. She felt bad that he was taking his birthday so hard. Could it be the commute, the pressures at work, a real midlife crisis? As long as he doesn't get a girlfriend, she quipped. Traffic at the mall was unusually light. The most obvious place to start would be the sporting goods store. Dave loved to deep-sea fish, but he hadn't found much time for it as of late. There were dozens of displays sporting shiny tackle, strange hooks, and assorted water gear. How would she know what to get? And with his busy schedule, would it just cause frustration? She wandered over to the baseball equipment. He was in his element as the batting coach of Brad's team. She scanned the aisle. As near as she could tell, he had everything. Unsettled, she walked out into the mall and toward the department store at the opposite end. She could always get him shirts and ties. He loved to dress well. Yet that was like buying him underwear for Father's Day. This was his 40th birthday. Her gift needed to be special. It needed to be something he would love, something he'd remember. She browsed through a few clothing racks, then checked her watch. Out of time. Another day, perhaps? She crossed the common area and headed for the exit, when a glance toward a display window near the door stopped her cold. Her heart raced as she placed her hands on the glass. It was perfect, and he'd never guess it in a gazillion years. She hurried inside and checked the price tag. $795. He'd totally freak if he found out. But it was his birthday. She'd take a chance. She ran her fingers across its surface, then held it up to the mirror.
You like it? The clerk inquired.
Can I bring it back after he drools all over it? She retorted. The clerk laughed.
As long as you keep the receipt.
I'll take it.
That quick? You saw the price. Is the size okay?
Yeah, it's perfect. Megan bounced with excitement as the girl removed a large zippered bag from beneath the counter, opened it wide, and placed the black leather motorcycle jacket inside. When they had first married, Megan had cut Dave's hair to save money. In time, he'd grown accustomed to the arrangement and refused now to go anywhere else. She loved it because they could chat. And today, there was gossip that just couldn't wait.
You'll never guess, Megan said, not intending to give him a chance to try. It looks like Rob and Cindy are splitting up.
What?
Yup, her phone died, and so when she borrowed his, she found a text he'd sent to a woman at his office that was, well, let's just say the message was unusually descriptive.
You're kidding.
It's true. I feel so bad for her.
What a jerk. And he still has my leaf blower. Are they selling the house?
I don't think it's gone that far yet.
He was contemplative, silent.
What are you thinking? She asked.
I was thinking that I'd better delete my text messages.
She tugged the hair on the back of his neck.
Ouch!
You forget I'm holding scissors.
I surrender.
She checked the length and back. Since you gave up so easily, I have a surprise for you.
A surprise?
Dave held steady as she cut behind his ear.
You know how your birthday is coming up?
No party, you promised.
We've been over that already. I wouldn't dream of it.
So what is it?
I've made arrangements to have the kids stay at my sister's next weekend. It's spur of the moment, I know, but You seem tense lately. I thought that we could drive down to Annapolis for the weekend. His eyes widened. I love that place. Oh, but I can't. There's a new account at work. Yeah, I thought you'd say that. I talked with Ellen yesterday. She agreed. I only had to twist her arm a little. We can leave first thing Friday morning. Dave turned to face her. You called my boss? I asked Brock first. He agreed and backed me up. She watched the corners of his mouth slowly turn up. Thank you, thank you, she added, offering a bow to her pretend audience. Dave was chuckling now at the thought. You're terrific, you know that? Happy birthday, she whispered, as she bent over and kissed his lips. As Dave pulled away, he felt the need to apologize. Listen, I'm sorry for being so down lately. I never thought the turning 40 thing would bother me, but I guess it has. It shouldn't. I know. It's just strange. One day I'm 20, full of aspirations, excited for life's adventures that are just around the bend. Then, the very next day, I'm 40, and I'm not sure I can even see the bend anymore, and, well, it's exasperating. And then, you surprise me with the perfect gift. She shrugged. What can I say? I'm just the perfect little wife. Dave wasn't finished. Best of all, you knew not to plan one of those lame surprise parties. Everyone giving you dopey over-the-hill gag gifts. I'd go off the deep end. I'm telling you, honey, you always know just what I need. Megan reached for the broom and began to sweep. Seconds ticked before she answered. What can I say to a compliment like that? Another long moment passed. And don't worry, I would never plan one of those silly over-the-hill parties. Never in a million years.
Chapter 6. I accepted the assignment to research the bridge. I'll begin after I finish my current project, 14th Century Artists, and then take a 2-week vacation. I don't have any place to go, though I should just pick a Caribbean island and buy a ticket. The sunshine would do me good. I just find it awkward and lonely to vacation alone. My father and I used to go on adventures together when he could get a weekend off. They weren't to exotic locations, usually just up the coast. There was a little hotel near the beach in Mendocino that was his favorite. We'd ride bikes, go to movies, or just sit on the beach and people watch. Of course, the only people that he'd ever watch were those wearing bikinis. I'd tease him and we'd both laugh. I miss his laughter. We actually had a weekend trip planned just before he was killed. But, as often happens in life, I was busy with my job at the university, and I asked him to postpone it a month. I wish so badly now that I'd taken the time. I won't be using my vacation to head up the coast. I've only been back to the hotel in Mendocino once since his death. I cried most of the night, and then drove straight home early the next morning. I'm taking 2 weeks off because I haven't used any vacation time in almost 2.5 years. And if I don't use at least part of it by summer, I'll lose it. It's a ridiculous policy. But then again, I work for a university, a place where too many smart people are confined in too small a space. So odd policies happen. The professor assures me that even with a couple of weeks off, I'll still have plenty of time to take on the society's assignment, The History of the Bridge. Their deadline isn't until late summer. He was ecstatic that I accepted, and that alone makes me nervous. It's not that I don't trust him. He's just so meddlesome, and I've learned from sad experience that when the professor meddles, it means there's a bad date in my future. I apologize for sounding negative. In truth, I've always been a romantic, always wanted to settle down and have a family. Currently, the notion feels so fleeting and distant. I mentioned that I was single and 26, that I lived with my father until his death. While all of that is true, and I'm still looking for someone to spend my life with. I haven't always been alone. At 21, with 2 semesters left before graduation, my first graduation,